Since childhood, British naturalist Michael Blenko has been obsessed with extinct animals. And now he's brought some to life, as it were, in a beautiful book called Gone, A Search for What Remains of the World's Extinct Creatures. It's funny and poignant and fascinating as he travels to the last resting places of creatures in far-flung museums and explains how they came to disappear from the planet. The book spans 5 centuries and includes the last sighting of New Zealand's upland moa and the death, less than a decade ago, of Lonesome George, the last Penta Island giant tortoise. Michael Blenko says of all the creatures in the book, it's the huia, our extinct wattle bird, that he misses the most.
So when I was a young boy, the book I had was a book called Extinct Birds by a chap called Errol Fuller. And the huia was the bird on the cover. And to me, it just seemed such a strange bird. So there was, you know, the female with a long beak and the male with a sort of short beak. It's such a strange, unusual bird. But also, it seemed really exotic. And growing up in England here, the idea of this bird from New Zealand, and New Zealand seemed like this amazing place, miles and miles away on the other side of the world, as far away from me as I could imagine. And I guess that was the sort of lure of this strange bird living in this strange place on the other side of the world.
And of course, you came to New Zealand, spent quite a lot of time here, because other birds that feature in your book are the South Island kokako and the upland moa. Just as a matter of interest, why did you choose the upland moa, which is by no means the largest moa, quite a relatively small moa?
I guess when I went over to New Zealand, and you know, I saw lots of remains of the moa over there, and there was something, again, something I'd seen in a book somewhere as a child, and it was this leg, a moa leg, which still had sort of flesh and feathers and fibre on it. It looked like it had been run over by a car last week. It seemed so recent. And I went to Otago Museum down there in Dunedin, and that's where they had this leg of an upland moa. And it was there in a little back room in the dark. And that, again, it was something which sort of spoke to me from my childhood. There's this, and it's quite a sinister thing, this huge claw, and this, you can see the muscles and the feathers, as I say, in the leg. But it was something from my childhood. And I think of all the moa, I think that was the one which sort of stuck with me as I travelled through New Zealand. That was the exhibit I saw which sort of stuck with me. So it's a personal thing with the upland moa.
The huia is unusual in that most of the creatures you feature were made extinct on account of being eaten. But the huia was killed for its tail feathers, first by Maori and finished off by Europeans and, of course, the introduced predators. And bulla, and you talk a bit about bulla. Bulla is a bit of a villain in New Zealand in terms of conservation. Is that the way you would see him?
Yeah, he's a strange man, Kim. I tried to like him. I really did. I tried to like him. He did, you know. I guess I would say he's a complicated character. On one hand, he was making him say he wrote the book, of course, about, you know, the history of the birds in New Zealand. You know, he did some great things for sort of conservation, but at the same time, he was proclaiming to save the huia and other species. At the same time, of course, he was getting these specimens to send back to collectors over in Europe. So yeah, it's a I tried not to make him the villain too much, but it was hard because, as I said, he was a complicated character. He did some good things. He did some good things, but also some quite sinister things as well.
The only excuse we can offer these people is that they were products of their time. And I'm not sure whether he can use that excuse, because by that stage, surely people realised that things could become extinct.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there's a story, of course, that there was, you know, that sort of the help arrived a little bit too little too late for the huia. But there were people trying to save the huia, trying to move these birds to offshore islands where relatively predator free, and there's stories, of course, of people actually trapping huia to release them on these safer islands. And in one instance, a pair which are destined for one of these offshore islands, which could have bred and saved the huia for the future were actually intercepted by Mr. Buller and sent back to England. And they never actually arrived here. The live pair of Huya sent back here never actually arrived. But again, there was hope there at the end. But as I say, Buller got involved. I can't put a spanner in the works. For that, I can't forgive him, unfortunately.
He wanted to send them back to Rothschild's estate at Tring, did he not?
That's right, yeah. And throughout the book, Mr. Rothschild looms large. He was a big bloke and a big character. And he was involved, of course. He had this estate in Tring, and he was a big collector. He was probably the pinnacle of Victorian collectors, Mr. Rothschild. And we'll find him again in the book where he was getting involved with the Galapagos tortoises and collecting those species as well. As you say, these people are sort of their time. And it's strange when these animals are dying out. For many people, it wasn't a case of how can we protect them and save them for the future. It was very much, let's get specimens now before they get wiped out forever. So conservation wasn't always the first thought in people's minds.
Right. How can we record them rather than how we can save them?
Yeah, I guess if you see this sort of, I talk about in the book on the Galapagos Islands, these tortoises over there were being slaughtered and killed for the pot. And they said, well, basically, if we don't get specimens now, they're going to be lost and eaten forever. So I guess having some specimens of these things is something at least. But as I say, people's thoughts weren't on conservation. Of course, that's very different these days.
Let's talk about the tortoise that you feature, Lonesome George, a Pinto Island tortoise from the Galapagos. When did he die? Quite recently.
Yeah, I remember the day was about 10 years ago, 2012.
Yeah,
I remember sort of turning the news on and seeing that the last ever Pinto Island tortoise had died. It's very usually, of course, when a species dies, we're not always sure the exact date, but we're pretty sure that Lonesome George was the last Pinto Island, so we can put a date. And it made the news worldwide. But saying that, it was quite strange because as I was researching and writing this book, I wrote also about another extinct species from the Galapagos, the Fernandina Island tortoise. And that was last seen and last killed on April the 4th, 1906, by a chap called Rollo Beck. And that's very well documented. Hasn't been seen since. So as I was writing the book, suddenly they found another one. So it's been, 1906, the last one. And then 2019, someone went to the island in the Galapagos, and they found another one. And it's just been confirmed it is definitely a Fernandina Island tortoise. So it's possibly been alive for over 100 years. It could well have been there in 1906 when the guy was killing what we thought was the last one. So luckily, he didn't see this one, and it survived.
Maybe never say never, because when you were in New Zealand, you were on the Hifi track, and you met one of the takahe that have been recently introduced there. They were supposedly extinct until they were found in the Murchison Mountains. People still think the South Island kōkako might be out there, although I think you think that they've seen a tui who's had the wattles made yellow from pollen.
Yeah, I'm quite a cynic, and I do admire and envious of these people who are out there looking for their kōkako, and they're full of optimism, full of hope. And as I write in the book, I'm kind of sort of jealous of that that hope they have. But even a few days ago, people made a recording of what they think is a kōkako. Now, I played it, of course, and it's very distant, but the people who are looking for this bird are convinced that's what they heard. As you say, Kim, the takahe vanished for 50 years. Maybe the kōkako is out there, and I'd love to be proved wrong. I really would.
The other charming thing about your book is not only the creatures, but also the individuals, not unpleasant ones like Buller. Some of the characters you describe are extraordinary. Stöhler, who was the early 18th century naturalist, tell me about his extraordinary adventure.
Yeah, Stöhler. Georg Stöhler he's my hero. This guy was passionate about nature, passionate about wildlife, and he went on an expedition over from Siberia all the way over with Bering across to discover the north of America there. And it was a terrible expedition. The whole thing went totally, totally wrong. People were dying of scurvy, and Stöhler and the crew got shipwrecked in 1741 on a remote island, which no one had ever visited before. And there he found some incredible wildlife, especially the Stöhler's sea cow, which I talk about in the book. Another of my favorite extinct species, 10 tons in weight, like a big manatee, 9 meters long. And Stella writes so passionately and so respectfully of this animal. And unfortunately, through discovering this species, discovering this island, soon the fur hunters went over there. Of course, they used the sea cow for food. And 27 years after it was discovered, it was made extinct. But Stella, yeah, I really, something about Stella, which I sort of link with, is he seems very frustrated with the world and everyone around him, but very passionate and very focused on wildlife. And I guess it's something which I feel at times.
The sea cow, Stella's sea cow, he was originally called Stirler and he changed his name, right? Or it was changed for him.
Yeah, yeah. I think when he got to St. Petersburg, he realised people couldn't pronounce his name properly. So it was Stoller was changed to Stella.
Hence, it's the Stella sea cow. An extraordinary thing, as you say, huge and massacred for food. I mean, that's the only reason it's extinct, right?
Yeah, I guess it was very slow, very tame. Of course, a lot of the species in the book, which I talk about, whether it's the moor or the Stella sea cow, they wouldn't have experienced humans before. And so, you know, weren't scared of them, didn't swim or run off. And so they're quite easily taken. The Stella sea cow, it's a really tragic story. The way it was so wastefully slaughtered, yeah, it's really quite heartbreaking, quite brutal in the book. So there are some quite sad bits in the book. I read a review yesterday that said I have some tissues handy, but hopefully I've managed to tone that down and leave a bit of hope in the book at the end as well.
Yeah, you have. We'll talk about the end because it's funny and sad at the same time. You start the book in the Booth Museum in Brighton, which was built, as these things were, by an ornithologist who loved birds so much that he shot them. Typical Victorian naturalist. But you love the Booth Museum, don't you?
Yeah, it's down in Brighton on the south coast of England here. And it's just tucked away on which is largely a residential street. And it's this very old, it's like a museum that belongs in a museum. It's they say it's built in 1874. Edward Booth, as you say, came a Victorian ornithologist. And yeah, he loved birds so much that he went out and shot them, which was, of course, what they did at the time. He had a collection. He wanted every different species of British bird in every different plumage. And of course, in a time before the TV, people could go to the Booth Museum and they would have seen these birds perhaps in books, but there they were stuffed in these lovely display cases. It's certainly of its time, but it's been sat there in that in Brighton for centuries now. It hasn't really changed, but it's a really it's a place I really enjoy going to. It's something you really sort of step back in time, and a feeling when you do step through those doors that time sort of stands still.
It's worth explaining, I think, Michael, how relatively recent the notion of extinction is, because it was long believed that nothing could become extinct because that would make God, the creator, fallible. And it wasn't until, I don't know, late in the 17th century that the idea of extinction became a reality.
Yeah, as you say, it was this idea that everything, you know, that everything was perfect, in God's plan. And the idea that something could just vanish, it wasn't even entertained. And so it was always assumed that if something had disappeared from somewhere, well, it's somewhere else. We'll find these things somewhere else. But after a while, people realised these somewhere else's just didn't exist.
Not all the creatures you've chosen are charismatic megafauna or beautiful birds. And we'll come to one of the perhaps least charismatic ones in a moment, but another is the San Francisco butterfly, Xerxes. Is that how you say it? Xerxes blue?
Yeah, Xerxes blue, yeah.
It became extinct purely because its habitat was destroyed.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So over here in England, I do a lot of work with butterfly conservation. So butterflies are a bit of a speciality of mine. And it's funny, I say, when I was researching the book, we know all about some of the bigger megafauna, as you say, some of the bigger, certainly the birds and the larger animals. But it's hard to sort of bring to mind an insect. But Xerxes blue was the first thing I thought of because it's actually given its name to the Xerxes Society over in America, which is a conservation society. It lives on in the name of a conservation group. But I heard about it. I didn't know much of the story. And when I was flying back from New Zealand on my trip, I stopped off in San Francisco And I thought I'd go and venture to where the this butterfly used to be. So a lot of San Francisco used to be sand dunes on the western side of the peninsula there. Of course, that's been built on. There's very few sand dunes left. As the San Francisco area grew and grew, it's moved onto those sand dunes, and it's built on the home of the Xerxes Blue. And on top of that, of course, there were collectors who were taking these specimens. And one poor chap, Harry Lang, will go down in history as the guy who netted the last Xerxes Blue in 1941 and put it in a pot. Little did he know at the time it was the last one that ever be seen. And I think that weighed heavy on him for the rest of his life. I think he said something like, "You know, I never thought it would be the last one, but I was wrong." So Butterfly Leshy was killed by San Francisco. But unfortunately, the last capture lays at the feet of poor old Harry Lang.
Gosh, I mean, he would have had no means of knowing. Same with the Great Auk, right? The Great Auk, which was eaten by sailors and explorers, and it found its final habitat, I think, on a rock off Iceland called Eldey, the last known breeding pair. But there was a lone one captured on St Kilda in 1821, you tell us, which really was declared a witch and beaten to death.
The St Kilda, a Great Auk, is very famous. It's gone down in legend because, they captured it. And at the time, I guess Great Auks were very, very rare by the 1820s around the British Isles. And so it would have been an unusual bird for the fishermen to capture. Apparently, when they captured it, a storm started to brew. And they assumed the bird and the capture of the bird has something to do with that. Also, the terrible noise it made when they brought it back on shore, they just assumed it must be a witch. And because of that, it was beaten to death. And so that's about 1821, sorry. And only a few decades later, in 1844, the last pair on Eldey were strangled and killed. And in the book, I go and visit a museum over in Copenhagen where they still have the eyes and the hearts of the last pair of Great Auk floating there in a jar in a museum. And it's hard when you see the last the eyes of the Great Auk, the last pair. It's hard not to imagine them seeing the boats and the men coming off the boat and climbing on the rock, grasping for them. It's also hard not to imagine seeing the heart and imagine the last few beats as a species dies out.
One of the saddest things is that a lot of these creatures, Stella sea cow and the Great Auk and the dodo and our birds in New Zealand, they were friendly, they were benign, they were fearless. Mm. And that was why they were able to be massacred in such quantities.
I think that's been, they say a lot of these birds, a lot of these animals were not seen humans before, were not seen us as a threat. And I guess, with the Moor, I'm sure, that they were probably as bemused at us as we were of them when we first arrived on New Zealand. But you could probably walked over to one and hit one with a stick and just killed it there and then, I'd imagine. I found a very old article about the Huya from, I think it was the, forgot the name of the newspaper now, but there was the Wednesday Evening Post, that was it. There was an article in there about a camping trip in 1901. And, people would go out into the out in the bush and the Huya would come down and sort of hop around them, within arm's reach and just, very inquisitive, not cautious at all about humans. A lot of these animals would have had the same reaction to rats and to stoats and to dogs and to pigs. That they would have been, just bemused by what these animals are and not seen them as a threat.
I'm talking to Michael Blenko about his book Gone, A Search for What Remains of the World's Extinct Creatures. I think you found that the world, and indeed New Zealand, is quite a small place, and there are many connections. You talk about Walter Mantell, who came here. He was the son of Gideon and Mary, and they had made quite a name for themselves in Britain. And the villainous Richard Owen had a vendetta against Gideon. Can you tease that story out for me a little more, please?
As I say, going through the book, there's a few heroes of mine in this book, but there's also a few villains as well. And Richard Owen was an amazing naturalist, an amazing scientist. But also, he wasn't a nice man. He wasn't a nice man at all. And it's hard to find any nice words about him. He seemed to have this sort of hunger for glory. He wanted to be the first person to describe these species. He wanted to have his name, on the scientific papers. when these species were being announced. Gideon Mantell was kind of a lowly chap who lived not too far from where I'm sitting now in Lewes, in Sussex. And for some reason, Richard Owen didn't like him at all, and he did his best to undermine all of Mantell's work. But yeah, in many stories in the book, you see Richard Owen sort of swooping in and claiming the glory and belittling others. But yeah, Gideon Mantell, he's quite a hero here. And at the Booth Museum, where the book starts, we have a little Gideon Mantell exhibition there with a few specimens and some pictures and stuff. But he lived not too far from the Booth, only a few miles north of Brighton. But I was very surprised when I came to New Zealand. I came down to Wellington and to Te Papa to find the main fossil, the key fossil in Gideon Mantell's history was this tooth, which helped the first ever fossil, which was led to the discovery of the dinosaurs. And actually, as you say, his son Walter came to New Zealand. It actually now resides in the in Te Papa there. And I did ask, it wasn't on display. Te Papa was being had some renovations at the time. It wasn't on display, and I did ask if I could see the tooth. But they seem a little bit wary, Kim, to let me see the tooth. I think they could have been worried about me trying to smuggle it back into the Booth Museum, back to Britain. I'm sure it does. It belongs back in the Booth, I tell you. It should be back in the Booth.
Oh, no. It's the Elgin Marble.
Exactly.
Why does the dodo have the status of being the iconic extinct animal? How did it achieve that?
Yeah, the dodo's it's the superstar of extinction. I visit a chap's house. There's a bungalow in Sussex. There's a chap there, a lovely old fella, who's obsessed with dodos. Rafe Whistler, he's obsessed with dodos. And you walk into his house and he has dodo key rings, dodo T-shirts, dodo mugs, huge statues of dodos. It's an animal which kind of took on legendary status. Again, there were so few specimens of the dodo that at one point we didn't even think it was a thing. They didn't think it even existed. And of course, it appears in Alice in Wonderland. It became quite a legend from appearing in that book. And I guess that sort of brought about some of its fame.
But actually, you explain that it's likely that Charles Dodgson, a.k.a. Lewis Carroll, saw the remains of a dodo in the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford and thus immortalised it in Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, he would have gone to that museum and he would have taken some children there. You know, one of those children was Alice, and he would have told stories. Now, the story is that Charles Dodgson had a bit of a stutter, and so he called himself Dodo Dodgson. And he certainly aligned himself with the dodo, and that would have featured in his stories, and of course, then featured in his book, Alice in Wonderland. The iconic remain of the extinct animal I was trying to see in Oxford was the dodo head, and he would have seen this specimen. It's the most complete dodo skull which remains, and it's now not on display at the moment. It's put away in a back room, but I was privileged to go and have an audience with this with the dodo head. Again, it was something which I'd seen drawings of and photographs of in books since I was a small boy, and the moment when they opened the box was quite a special moment to me when I came nose to beak with the Oxford dodo.
There's a beautiful scene. I mentioned this less than charismatic creature that you feature. There's a beautiful scene at the end of the book with you drifting across a suburban lagoon on an inflatable crocodile searching for Ivel's sea anemone. Could you tell me how it came to this, please?
Yeah, it was when I was researching the book. I mean, as I say, I started off listing some of my favourite, as it were, extinct animals: the dodo, the Stella's sea cow, the huya, and others. And what I discovered while I was researching the book was in Britain, the last animal to go extinct in Britain was the great auk. But then I was wrong, because not too far away from where I live, in fact, only about a 10-minute drive away, there is a lagoon on the side of the just down by the coast down here, on the side of a suburban area, and I've driven past it many times, but this was the only place where Ivel's sea anemone has ever been seen. It was discovered in the 1970s, and it was extinct. It hasn't been seen since the 1990s, and it really sort of drove something home to me that extinction to me is something, you know, for many people it happens on islands far away in the Pacific, or, you know, these distant lands many hundreds of years ago. That's not actually true. Extinction is happening all around us right now. And as I say, this extinction happened just 10 minutes down the road from me only a few decades ago. So it really sort of drove home how pressing are the challenges that we face right now.
I mean, who knows what the figures are really, but it's estimated that maybe 1 million of the world's 8 million species now face extinction. And that's the subtext, if you like, of your entire book. You don't dwell on it, but it's obvious that what you are saying is that unless we do something, then a whole lot more creatures are going to be gone and we're going to be sorry about it.
That's a book in itself, of course. And I think when I approached this topic of extinction, I didn't want to sort of lay it on too thickly. I thought what I'd do is I'd tell the stories to remind people of what extinction is and what it feels like, and you know, to lose species. So by telling these stories of the people and the species, of course, you kind of get a feeling of loss. And that's what we're facing now. And I say I don't lay it on too thick, but you're right, Kim. I mean, you know, they're talking about, you know, 1 million of the world's 8 million species. Today on the news, I saw they were saying 1 in 3 wild tree species face extinction. Kind of, you know, I kind of just say keep it as a subtext. It's always there in the background. But at the end, I hopefully get a message across that, you know, now is the time to really sort of take action and start challenging these figures.
We can't save everything. And indeed, extinction is part of evolution. I mean, as they discovered, things become extinct because the world changes. How do you decide what should be saved, do you think?
Yeah, that's a tough question, Kim. Yeah, it's, you know, I guess it's just the feeling that, you know, we have a responsibility, you know, to look after this planet. And as you say, extinction is a natural process. It happens, you know, over thousands and millions of years. But at the moment, because of our actions, it's happening at an accelerated rate, 10 to even 100,000 times faster than the average for the past 10 million years. So, you know, we have a responsibility to do this. And as to what we focus on, I mean, it's tough. I mean, we have limited resources at the moment in the face of these threats. But you know, to me, it's about, you know, if we all focus on what is in our local area, in what's in our backyard, that's a start. As I say, there's things that have gone extinct just down the road from me, and there's birds in my local area now which are threatened with extinction, things like turtle doves and nightingales, which we're losing from England. And so, you know, I say to people, well, maybe focus on things locally, get involved with conservation work in your area, support local conservation charities as well as the international ones. We can all do something. I think it's easy to sort of to read these figures and feel that there isn't much we can do. But there are things in your local area where you can help out and take action. Of course, that's you know, certainly in New Zealand, that's a key thing that's happening right now. People are so inspired when I came to New Zealand to see the action people were taking, whether they're scientists, naturalists, or even school children were taking to help the species you have in New Zealand, which are being pushed towards the brink of extinction.
And when you were out there looking for Ivel's sea anemone, the last lines of your book on your inflatable crocodile, you say, "I'm out here floating over the black, murky clouds with a faulty torch, searching for something shining in the darkness. I guess that's what hope is after all." Which reminded me, I have to say, Michael, of the last lines of The Great Gatsby. So we beat on. Boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. Yes, it's a lovely line because it expresses everything that you've been saying, that we are ill-equipped, but the only thing we've got is hope that we can find the things we have not yet destroyed.
It's funny, you know, coming to New Zealand a few years ago to research the book, and you know, I left with such a feeling of hope, seeing what is being undertaken in New Zealand to try and save some of the more threatened species on the islands over there. It was really, I was so inspired. I came back with, you know, with so much hope, and to see, well, you know, people are really trying to do stuff and are having real results over there, real positive results. And so you have to have hope, because without hope, you have nothing.
Very nice to talk to you. Thank you. Thank you for the book. I hope that you will be able to return to New Zealand at some stage.
I hope so. I hope so. It's my, I tell you, that as soon as I'm allowed back in, I'll be on the first flight.
That's Michael Blenko, whose book's called Gone.